From you guys about it? Any follow-up questions? We got a good response on the cooking class. There's about eight on there now. If you, the form is, I sent the form to you in an email, but it's also on the website now. So if you want to, this isn't a commitment, but if you want to express some availability information, please do. I want to send her the results maybe tomorrow or the next day. I might send you an email reminder, but it should be a great experience. I'd like to do it too. If the class makes it, if I can do it, I'll go. Any other thoughts on Jenny's visit? Any questions? Yeah, please.
Well, I wasn't here, but they mentioned, like, I don't know if you mentioned this, how much it would cost, because I think you
sure.
Said that.
Yeah, it's a multi-hour cooking class. It's going to be $25. It's pretty standard. You're going to come home with a dinner. You're going to come home with ideas about how to make a bunch of dinners in this kind, and she's going to give you some nutrition information. So she felt a little nervous about 25 versus 20, but you know, she's in business, and she's got to do it at a price that works. I'm kind of excited to see her kitchen. She's making a lot of meals a week now, and so she's kind of in a neat place. She may have mentioned to your class that she's looking at funding for a lease to get her some shop space where she'd have her own kitchen, and so she's kind of at this nice point. And I know in both classes we have some business students and or students who are interested in business, so I just thought it would be interesting. It would also be interesting for you to see a food entrepreneur, meet a food entrepreneur. So okay. Any food news from you guys? Yes.
I guess today or yesterday, I read it today, Congress had this big debate over buying junk food stamps.
Yeah, is that right? Good. That's in the news again? Or it's in it reaching some getting some attention?
So
good. Yeah.
So
I have no idea why we let people buy sodas with food stamps. I don't mean to punish people who are poor. I mean, I don't think it's punishing. I think you're helping them. But it does stigmatize a group, right? Because when you're at the checkout counter, And somebody is buys something inappropriate with their food stamps, it kind of creates this kind of like, oh yeah, you're so yeah, that's an interesting issue. Do you have thoughts on whether it should be changed?
I mean, it's hard because like I'll buy chips every once in a while too, so it's hard to like chastise people for doing that. But sometimes like all they buy is a ton of
absolutely
of this and that,
right,
and then there's nothing of substance in the rest of their order, which is kind of sad to see.
Right.
Also, like,
right. Well, you know, it's a good point, because how would we analyze that now? We'd say, in one sense, they're doing something rational. They're buying as many cheap calories as they can. If I, you know, food stamps can sometimes be like a couple $100 for a family for a month, you know. So they're subsidies. But it also kind of reminds me, your comment kind of reminds me, that the policy might depend on what you think food is. And we're going to take a little digression today, you know, now that we have a bunch of what is food answers to the question, what is food? Because, yeah, if you say, well, they're food stamps, so they should be spent on food, you could approach it that way and say, well, what is food? If soda counts as food, then...
Yeah. I think they should do it more like WIC does, where there's like a book of things you can and can't buy.
Yeah, that makes sense to me, too. I'm just a little reluctant to force people to buy... force poor people to buy more expensive calories, because even though the less expensive calories are less nutritious, you know, getting your calories... This might be the issue for some people. Yeah, good. Very good food news item. Yeah.
I read an article, I think, 2 days ago in Time saying it was, like, a new study in, like, 10 ways to slash calories, and I was kind of comparing it to see if they had anything from Pollen's recommendations. The only one that, like, crossed paths was don't eat in front of the TV.
Oh, but they didn't take any of the other algorithms.
I mean, they had... I pulled it up.
Yeah.
They said, drink your tea and coffee plain without milk or creamers, get more fiber, swap soda for...
Okay.
So they're kind of more...
They,
like,
picked a few things.
Picked direct.
Right.
Yeah, but I thought it was interesting that you did.
Yeah, one of the things I like about the idea of studying food is that you can, when you run across news articles like that, you've got something to bring to bear on it. You know, you can say, well, you know, I know something about it now. Good. Others?
Yeah. The Grocery Manufacturers Association and the Food Marketing Institute announced that they're going to, like, standardize the expiration labels. So there's only going to be, like, two variations.
Interesting.
Apparently before there was, like, 10.
What's the effect of that, do you think?
It's, like, to reduce consumer confusion.
Oh. So instead of having... wouldn't the expiration labels have to depend on the product? I don't...
Well, because, like, they used to say, like, what is it, expires on, or, like, better if used by...
Oh,
like,
right,
like,
right,
so,
right. That is confusing.
So they're just
going to have
two now.
Best by the states,
sell by,
right.
By.
You sell by... Oh, yeah, that is huge. So now what are the two that they're going
to... The two that use now is used by and best if used. Best if used by.
Yeah. That's interesting. Good.
Oh, two's better than 10.
Yeah. Yeah, right. That is interesting. Good. Good. Okay, anything else? I missed the article because I wanted to put it on the website, but Sunday, God, is it raining a lot? Yeah. Sunday, last Sunday, yeah. There was this really interesting article about heat. I'll find the article and I'll put it on the site. I don't want to do it this way now. So okay. Anything else? Yeah. We're good. All right. Before we get into our class, I wanted to actually give you a bit of quantitative nutritional data. We're going to be doing a lot of this when we study our nutrition chapters, right? And I wanted to also make a pitch. I made this pitch to the other class too. That I'm a little nervous about teaching science. I don't know how to teach science, frankly. I mean, I'm a philosopher, but I made myself study these chapters and I studied the whole book. And there is an optional assignment where you help me present stuff, and that can be just depending upon your interest. But we have majors here in sports management, physical therapy? No, it's not called physical. Physiology. We've got bio majors, biochem majors. We've got people in the class who would probably be able to help me present this. So if you're inclined to do that with me, you could pick one of the nutrition chapters. And what I don't want to do is give you a quiz on one of these chapters. They're just really dense with information. What I want to do is pick out the functional information, the things you can do with this information, and some of them involve quantitative data. So when I was thinking about this, I thought, well, and then I was embarrassed because the last class I couldn't remember these macronutrient ranges. So if you could just take a few notes on this will just take 5 minutes, and it kind of kicks off our quantitative study of nutrition. It's also relevant because we're going to use the last 15 minutes of class for the people who are doing the diet tracking thing. And getting some of this into the discussion for the people who are doing that might be helpful. So just real quick, just to kind of ease my conscience on having failed you last time with this information. So let's just do a little bit of this. It might be redundant for some of you. So the ranges refer to the percent of calories per day that you get from the macronutrients. So the correct ranges are 40 to 65% for carbohydrates, 20 to 35% for fat, and 10 to 35% for protein. I have no idea how you get to 35% protein. Maybe some of you guys have diets with 35% protein. But and then it helps to know that this is calories per gram, that fat and protein have 4 calories per gram. I'm sorry, carbs and protein have 4 calories per gram. Fat has 8. So fat is calorically dense per weight, right? I mean, one reason people have this lipid phobia is that it is actually pretty caloric. I should mention that alcohol comes in at 9 calories per gram. So, for instance, you could take a 12-ounce beer. 12 ounces converts to 340 grams. If it's a 5% alcohol beer, you could just multiply out. Take the 5%, right? So you know that 17 grams of your beer comes from alcohol, right? So then you would take the 17 grams and you'd multiply it by 9, and that's your calories from alcohol. Then you take the remainder and you multiply it by 4, and that's your calories from carbs. Does that make sense?
So this is 340 represented in?
I should do that better. That's a 12-ounce bottle in grams. So to do this gram calc, you have to kind of switch things. But if you do that and look at the beer label, it'll check out.
Is that for that's
what fat has 9 grams of calories.
Oh, fat is 9?
Yeah, that's what I...
Oh, is alcohol 8? Could you look that up?
I don't know about alcohol.
Could somebody look that up? I might have confused them. I thought fat was 8. You know? Could somebody look up how many calories are in a gram of alcohol? Fat is 9. Okay, I got it wrong again. Sorry. maybe alcohol is 8. Is alcohol 8?
No, it's just 7.
Alcohol is 7? Hey, that's good news.
Wow.
Okay, good. Yeah. All right, that's most of what I had, except a couple more details. One is the general rule is you need 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. So that's kind of a good thing to know. You can convert your weight into kilograms, and that gives you kind of a rough idea. Old people like me need about 1.2 because we're not as efficient. And so the bioavailability of protein is lower for me. Oh, well. Okay? The other thing I'd add, just in a nutshell, these are like what I would consider the most basic measures that you could actually take out after today and use, right? You can start thinking of your food. It doesn't take that long. You can look up a green pepper 5 times. Eventually, you get it right. It's about 100 and some calories, and I'll get it wrong if I try to do it off the top of my head. But my point is that, you know, we've been on the heels of our discussion of food pyramids and how you represent healthy diets, you know, we're headed into a much more precise, if you will, or no, it's not quite the right word, much more detailed way of thinking about your food. And this may not be congenial to some of you. Remember, there's the pollen eating algorithms, which are non-quantitative, but I want us to give this a shot, because you could start thinking about your food in terms of that, of this, if you look at your label. Okay. The other thing would be that, and I put a couple of links on here, it's a puzzle to a lot of people that the food labels are based on a 2,000 calorie diet, but that's not the right level for everybody, right? The calorie, you could look at a calorie calculator, right? Have any of you done that? Feel free to pull it up now if you want. But, you know, you put a calorie calculator, you put in your weight and your age, and you get a calorie recommendation, and also your level of activity. But there's an article here that I found a while ago from the Atlantic, which explains why the USDA uses the 2,000 calorie per day limit. And it's a really simple thing. I just want you to know it. It's because it's really easy for everybody to use 2,000 calories. So if I say, don't get less than 10% of your calories from sugar, then that means, you know, 200 calories. Of course, if you have a 2,500 calorie diet, you know, you could have a little more sugar probably. It's just a really easy number to calculate from, right? The other thing I might have mentioned about calories is that I really encourage you to look at the gastropod episode on the calorie. Because as you start to use numbers, it's helpful to know where the lack of precision in a measure is. So a calorie looks like a really solid measure. After you learn more about calories, you kind of find that it's kind of an approximation. Like, in the gastropod episode is really good for that. So I'd recommend that. Okay. Questions about this? It's maybe just a little redundant.
You mentioned the 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight.
Yeah.
How often?
These are RDA. Good. Yeah, these are RDAs. So this is
percent daily.
Recommended daily amount. Yeah. Good. Okay. So do you see how with just this information you could do a lot of calculating on your food, right? You're looking stuff up.
I work out a lot. So
yeah, good.
It says
yeah.
2,700.
That's high. Wow. If you're really doing that many workouts.
I work out a lot.
Good for you. Yeah. I have to say, you reminded me of a detail. There are two ways to think about calories per day, and I think this is relevant. When I first changed my diet, I started looking at these calorie calculators, and I came out at like 2,300 a day, 2,200, 2,300 a day. The other measure is to actually track your diet and over weeks notice whether your weight is stable. Because your actual, if your goal is to keep your weight stable, right? Some of you are trying to gain weight, some of you might want to lose weight, I don't know. But if your goal is to keep your weight stable, then the best way to think, I think the best way to think about your calories is in terms of actual weight and actual intake. Because your metabolisms are all different, right? So when I started tracking my calories and weighing myself, I found that an 1,800 calorie diet was stable. You know, 1,700 to 1,900 calories. And remember, don't imagine that these are precise numbers. Don't sweat 100 calories one way or another. These are not precise numbers. And one way to see the imprecision is to compare the chart method for figuring out your calorie level with a real method, like what happens when you eat, you know, this many calories.
It's also important to find your resting metabolic rate as well.
Oh, that's interesting.
With that, like how many calories you burn just by living and.
Oh, interesting.
Eating.
Yeah, I've never looked that up. That's neat. Oh.
There's a calculator for that as well.
Oh, cool. One of the things about academics is we lead pretty sedentary lives. You guys lead. We all work out too, but you know, we lead pretty. We have a lot of seat time. So. that my rest would that be relevant then to this resting metabolic rate?
Yeah, I think like someone who has like a average active lifestyle and who's I would say in their low 20s would have somewhere between a 1700 to 2000 resting metabolic rate.
That's interesting. Okay, so knowing that kind of tells you where you are relative to other people's metabolisms a bit.
Yeah, and then how many more calories you need to consume, because you don't burn as many calories you do in a workout rather than you do like living. So
right. Good. That's really good detail. Yeah.
Talking of like sedentary lifestyle, that reminded me of the Atlantic article I read a while ago about why Americans and like the developed world in general tend to be heavier is
mm-hmm.
one of the reasons they identified was that we're never cold.
How interesting.
And you burn a lot of calories.
How interesting. That's a neat detail.
And
I like
so
that.
They were identifying a bunch of companies that sell full body ice packs. And just, if you're sitting around, you can just put it on.
No.
And burn calories.
No kidding. Wow. Anybody heard of that? That's kind of news to me. That's great.
Cool. I could only think of the shivering would be the calorie burner. I can't really think of what else would.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe your heart beats faster trying to circulate blood.
It'd be good to learn. It'd be good to learn.
I've heard people doing like ice baths.
Is that right?
To burn calories.
No kidding. On the theme of sedentariness, I think a lot of Americans work out, and so we give ourselves a lot of credit for having an active lifestyle, but my comparisons, personally, when I'm in Europe versus here, are that I'm just much less sedentary because I'm not using a car all the time, and the lifestyle encourages walking and so on. So maybe that's pretty obvious, but those are all things that are going to affect your actual calorie burn rate. So I like the behavioral method for figuring out where my calorie level is. And if you're going to the gym, you're near a scale a lot, so you know it's not that hard to tell. Okay, good start. I hope this is a good start on this. We're going to add a lot of nutrition data, and I would love to have somebody to help me with it. Okay, we got some great stuff to talk about today, but let's do our little quiz first. Three questions. If you could load up the form. Sorry about that. What I liked about the Zepeda article is that this comes at the end of our study, our run-through of all the units, right? And she's basically saying a couple of things I want to highlight. She's saying, we have the food system that reflects our values. Right, and I like that because some of the documentaries and some of the Marion Nestle reading really appropriately demonized the food industry, but there's a limit to how much you can demonize the food industry, because if you take a deeper, more philosophical look at things, you find out maybe, and she's saying this, that the food industry reflects the values of the culture. So she starts her article with this responsibility question, because in the politics of food, as you know from your reading, the food industry always says, oh, it's a matter of consumer responsibility to eat responsibly, and that's true. On the other hand, she makes the point, and on the other hand, nutritionists say, you know, the food companies are selling us unhealthy, addictive foods, right? So that's kind of the back and forth on the public policy side. Her point is more philosophical. She's saying, the context affects the choice. So if you don't understand the cultural context, it doesn't make sense to just blame one party back and forth interminably. And so what is the context? And this is the point for your notes. Our culture, we have the food system that reflects our culture's values. That's her thesis, right? So let's list some of those values. They're up here. Let's see if we can pull them out. Some of this is redundant. I just want to consolidate it. Lots of cheap calories, low spending on food, and she adds little concern about the conditions of production of food. We don't care if food workers are doing so well. The history of social justice issues about food workers kind of reflects that. She also brings in she's trying to give you an idea of some of the hallmarks of different periods of our food history. So she goes way back, and this is an insight, I think. She goes way back to pioneer experience, and she says, look, our cultural values about food might have been influenced by westward expansion because pioneers experienced food insecurity. They experienced starvation. They needed foods that could be really stable. They needed foods that could hold up, you know, under difficult conditions. So our preference for cheap calories that are really stable and storable, interestingly, might relate to our pioneer experience. Even though we're not pioneers, Remember, cultures are funny things. They transmit values. So an American diet is distinctive globally for some of these features that we're now aware of, you know, cheap calories and so on. And so what she's trying to say is, you know, that could go way back to our pioneer experience of food insecurity. And later we're going to study the Thanksgiving story, but I don't think we need to do it now. So then in the post, she has a little post-war period, and the main detail there is that's when we started doing frozen dinners, that's when we stopped cooking. Then she takes into account the 90s. I wanted to see if you guys, 90s and 2000s, this is kind of the era you guys grew up in. And here's an interesting claim she makes. I don't know if this is true. Tell me what you think. She says what's distinctive about the 90s in food is that we started to not want authentic food. We started to want ethnic food that came under a brand we could trust. So we didn't want Mexican food. We wanted Kraft's enchiladas. You know, I don't know if Kraft makes enchiladas. So she said it's kind of an argument that you find in postmodern thought that we started to want the imitation. Does that make sense? Isn't that interesting? We started to want the imitation. I don't know if it's empirically true, but it sounds kind of right. And then she has a couple of other details, but the two main conclusions I wanted from this article were one, we have the food system that reflects our deep cultural values. We may not be aware of it, but we could be. That could be true. And second, and I didn't mention this yet, we have a food system that those values essentially produce energy-dense versus nutrient-dense food. So can we get that in your notes as a concept? Right? So these are just energy-dense versus nutrient-dense. How would you guys understand that in terms of what we know about nutrition here? I could do it for you, but... how would you define an energy-dense food versus a nutrient-dense food? This is a huge concept. Yeah.
I feel like, just to like a clarifying thing,
yeah,
it's
sure.
Not really an answer to your question.
No, that's okay.
What do we exactly mean when we talk about energy, like besides calories? Because I know when people eat a lot of energy-dense food, it doesn't exactly give them a lot of energy. So
depends.
What,
yeah.
So
energy-dense is defined by the relative proportion of food that can be used immediately by the body. So it tends to favor simple carbohydrates and sugars.
Okay.
Fats are energy dense. Nutrient dense foods per calorie have more of the nutrients you need for a day. So let's get that in your notes, I'll repeat it. Energy dense foods have a higher proportion of readily usable calories. Immediately usable calories. Nutrient-dense foods have a higher proportion relative to calories.
And
right?
So are you talking about, in nutrient-dense, are you talking about vitamins and minerals?
Well, right. So, okay, good. So let's make that clear. We've got macronutrients, right? Carbs, fats, and proteins. That's very helpful. Thanks. We've got micronutrients, which generally include vitamins. But we also have other categories of nutrients, which we've talked about, like phytochemicals, which are a little more recent. Antioxidants, which phytochemicals are, but there are other antioxidants that aren't phytochemicals. So, by micronutrients, we need known and recently discovered. This gets more complicated, but yeah. So it's a ratio of energy to calories versus nutrients to calories. So the argument is that if you base your diet on a nutrient-dense, if you have a nutrient-dense diet as your baseline diet, then it'll be more forgiving when you go into energy-dense drinks like sodas or things that have high levels of sugar. Okay, so that was the second thing I liked from Zepeda. Any thoughts from you guys on the Zepeda article? All right, so not too much from chapter two, but a little bit. Let's kind of see what Darwin gets us going. One reason I left chapter two in the course, or have chapter two in the course, is because maybe you guys were surprised by this too. Was anybody surprised that it's late 19th century and we're figuring out what worms do? Isn't that weird? I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to expect from humans. It's just, there's this general theme that I've mentioned before. I want to repeat it. The scientific revolution starts in like the 16th century. We figure out planetary motion. We have a better idea of where we are in the cosmos in the 16th century, then we have a good idea about what's happening in soil in the late 19th century. Isn't that kind of interesting? And it's not a mystery. It's because chemistry took a long time to develop. We didn't get chemistry until the 17th century. Okay, so that's the first thing. Is I'm like, wow, Darwin's helping us figure out what worms do. Second thing, it's also cool that explains why antiquities sink. I don't know if any of you are wondering about that. Second thing from this chapter, and then I'll kind of leave it to anything you guys might want to suggest. This chapter makes the point that, because, it, you know, there's the Darwin segment, remember, and then there's the more general geology segment on how soil is formed. Remember that? The rates at which soil is formed versus the rates at which it's depleted. So the point for your notes is the processes governing soil governing soils determine the possibility of plant and animal life. And that's a big claim, right? That's saying pay attention to the soil, right? Second way to put that, a little more detailed, is we ought to be looking for a balance between the processes that create soil and the processes which deplete it or erode it. Two different things, right? There's a slogan that comes up in a lot of food literature, which this chapter kind of reminded me of, but it's not quite, it's kind of a little tangential. It's that you are what you eat, and you are what you eat eats. Okay? And that's most of what I wanted to talk about in the chapter. I want to make a small digression on what is food on the basis of this. So can we just do this together? Hopefully this is... we might do a little 2 to 3 page paper after the break on the nature on what is food. I want to kind of pitch it for you today, and then maybe I'll come back and ask you, would that be a sensible thing for you to write about? I think you have a lot of resources in the course already for saying something interesting in a couple pages about what is food. So let me tell you what I mean by that. Let's just get a couple. I won't write these on the board, but let's just get a couple of definitions that come out of the course so far. First, food to nutrition. Perfectly reasonable definition. Second, food is a cultural artifact. You associate that with Montanari, right? Remember Montanari said, human food is, the moment of human food is when we separate ourselves, conquering time and space. Do you remember that? Right, we have epics where, you know, men are identified, being human is identified with eating bread, or eating a quick rice, or eating pigs.
To have a cuisine is to be civilized.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the claim, right? To have a cuisine is to be civilized. It defines us as humans. So you could say food is what defines us as humans, and it's a cultural artifact. Okay, third definition that is coming out of this reading and chapter 3. Food is an exchange relationship with living soil. That's what you get at the beginning of chapter 3, right? Or that's what you get throughout this book. But okay, get that in your notes. Good, thank you. Three very reasonable definitions of food. What's at stake in these definitions? When philosophers worry about definitions, there's a lot of things they could be worried about. They could be looking for the right definition, right? So sometimes there are objective criteria that say, you know, this is the right definition. Of it. So gravity has a correct definition. Sometimes when philosophers are playing around with definitions, that's not what they're doing. What they're doing is asking, what follows from looking at this phenomena this way? Like, if we define food like this, are there other things that follow from that? So could you look at those three definitions I just gave you, and let's just see, what difference does it make whether you adopt one or the other? This might take a couple of minutes. Just think about it at your seats by yourself. What difference does it make if you think of food as nutrition versus a cultural artifact or cultural achievement versus... I mean, they're all true in various degrees. It's not about picking one. Versus thinking about food as an exchange relationship with living soil. Let's take a minute to think about that. Do the definitions suggest different ways of dividing the world up? Do these definitions suggest different ways of thinking about nature versus culture? What do you think? Do you find yourself drawn to one definition over the others?
I
Who wants to take a start us off on this?
Yeah, please.
I think for me, it kind of depends on which lens you're looking at it from.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you're looking at it from a more human-centric lens,
mm-hmm.
you would say that it's a cultural artifact.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, that you're dealing it with more just the relationships between humans and food. I think if you were to look at it from the third one with soil, you're more looking at it as a lens where the interactions between humans and like the earth that we live on.
Yeah, I mean, can we say the third one's clearly an ecological,
right?
So it's more, so the third one calls less attention to our separateness from food and the earth.
And then I think the first one is more just that, like a scientific.
Yeah. Notice in the first one, does anybody want to add to that? That's great, good start. I don't want to do it all, unless that's the most efficient thing to do. Notice if you define food as nutrition, you're opening yourself up to, well, you're accounting for what's true, which is that we can synthesize nutrients. So even if I'm against industrial food, I think I have to acknowledge, if I'm being an honest philosopher, that there are synthetic foods. So in some ways, the nutrition definition has some pull that way, because it is true that food isn't tied to natural foods. We can synthesize. You can have, what's that product called again?
Soylent.
What?
Soylent.
Right. Crazy name for it.
Remember that from process.
Yeah. So that's the trade-off. And then with the nutrition definition, you're in danger of nutritionism. Do you remember that? The Gregory Syntis theory that Pollan talks about, which is so nutrition is a good definition, but it could have a liability. What I like about, let's get into chapter 3 here then. Oh, one more thing on this, what is food? Another choice you have is to say that food exists on a continuum from real to less real, versus a dichotomy where you say there's real food and there's fake food. And, you know, you could argue for either one. The point is that this one is much more open and permissive. So then on this one, anything that, you know, a soda might be less real than a piece of fruit if you have a criterion like that, but they're both food. On this one, you could say a lot of industrial food is imitation food. So this is kind of more like, where are you? What do you think is more accurate based on your study of food? Is it more accurate to say it's all food, some of it's more real than others, some of it's better than others, some of it's more nutrient dense? That would be one way to identify real food. Or do you want to say, you know, there's real food, which is, you know, you could take a real, this is a stronger position. There's real food, and that's maybe you would say that's plant-based natural food, and then everything else is kind of fake. We don't need to decide this today. If you have thoughts now, let's talk about them. But the point is that these are considerations or possibilities that would come up if you tried to say, what is food? Which is something you should be able to say on the basis of this course. So let's think about that some more. I'll come back to you and ask you if that's something that makes sense to write about. We can write about a lot of different things. So I would like some short writing from you guys shortly after spring break, if that makes sense. All right, so chapter 3, the coolest idea of the day, as far as I'm concerned, is this idea that we are living Earth. Isn't that interesting? Let's kind of work with that. Maybe it's kind of, maybe you can criticize. Maybe you'll say, it kind of sounds cool, but it's really nothing there. I think there might be something there. The idea that linguistically Adam means Earth and Eve means life, or the idea from Latin linguistics that homo refers to humus. I never understood that. I always thought homo meant the opposite of hetero. I never understood why we called ourselves homo sapiens. I always thought it was like, well, we're all similar to each other or something like that. That turns out to be linguistically false. It's because the word homo in Latin derives from the word for earth in Latin. So we define ourselves linguistically as creatures from the earth. And we have that, Montgomery makes that point, which I made to you earlier, about the garden, the myth of the garden representing a transition to agriculture. But let's stop for a minute and just think about this. It's literally true, right? I mean, it's weird to say, but we are literally blobs of gooey earth that are, sorry. No, we are. We came from the earth. So, you know, we came from the earth, and we couldn't exist until soil was created, right? So you got the story of soil erosion, of the soil creation. We are products of soil. We are Soylent. Soylent is people, right? That's, it comes out of this horrible sci-fi story, right, where Soylent turns out to be people, right? So do you resist that? Does anybody, or do you embrace that?
I definitely agree.
You think it's an interesting perspective changer, though.
If you are what you eat, and you are what
you eat, eats.
I mean, the origin is soil.
I mean, literally, we take up minerals. You know, right? Part of our micronutrients are things like magnesium and calcium. We have the cool little detail. We have the percentage of calcium in our body is pretty similar to the percentage of calcium in the earth. I mean, there's a kind of analogy there that's kind of literal. We literally eat rocks. You know, we metabolize minerals. We metabolize things that we can only find in earth. We can synthesize nutrients. Nobody's produced a real synthesized diet. People can't stay on Soylent for very long. It just makes them really weird. But the idea that we're literally of the soil, we're living soil, we're the soil that moves around, is kind of a weird idea, but I think it changes the perspective. And this book, we're going to read four chapters from this book, five chapters, one's really short. Next week we'll read three. And this, the theme of this book is precisely that we should be thinking of ourselves as part of the soil. Blobs of gooey soil running around trying to suck more nutrients out of the soil. It's a very interesting way to look at it. And here's another detail to add. We have a religious myth that told us that way before we knew it, ecologically. So the idea that Adam is soil and that Eve is life, whatever you think of the gender division there, I mean, we're both, men and women are both live soil, right? So I think that's kind of cool. It's in our language. The point is, it's in our language and religion before we knew it to be true, literally. I think that's very interesting. And then practically, it's interesting. Okay, what follows? Practically, if you define food in terms of our being soil, it changes your focus, right? So that's Montgomery's point. Okay, any thoughts on that? Anybody? Yeah, okay, we're good. Okay, so he gives you a lot of dates here. I don't want to go through that too much. Here's the part of the ones that matter, okay? It matters that 20,000 years ago, the last major period of glaciation ended. So here's what you need to know about glaciation, right? When glaciation occurs, Europe freezes and the Mideast has a drought. When glaciation recedes, the Mideast gets water again, gets temperature, gets precipitation again, and Europe thaws. Why is that important? Because the human relationship with food starts here, at least in this part of the world. Agriculture is independently discovered in Mesopotamia, Mesoamerica, and China, and India, right? All in the same temperate band around the earth. So Jared Diamond has an explanation for this. But the point is that, and the point for your notes is that humans start their relationship, modern humans, genetically modern humans, start their relationship with food in this seesaw relationship with glaciation, feast and famine. The Levant was thick with forests. You guys have seen images of Lebanon and Israel, Palestine. Greece, you know how our images of Greek landscapes are denuded, rocky, hills with the Parthenon on top of one of them, right? Greece used to be fertile. That was all, that soil eroded. Greece looks the way it does because we screwed up. So our experience, the general point is that our experience with food starts in a fluctuating relationship with glaciation, which produces drastic shifts in temperature and fertility of different parts of Europe and the Middle East. Second point, that ended roughly 20,000 years ago, but he points out that there would be episodes of glaciation, you know, it's like earthquake phenomena. You know, you don't just get one earthquake, you get a tremor, you get things that fall out. So the next point for your notes is that there was a mini glaciation around 10,000 BC in Europe, and called the Younger Dryas, and we can take pollen core samples from different tell us about the precipitation and amount of pollen in different time periods, and we find out that when the Younger Dryas comes in, what happens is that the Mideast gets a drought. So here's the point for your notes. Before the Younger Dryas glaciation, there was probably a population explosion in the Levant, Middle East, right? Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Israel, Palestine. So at the end of the glaciation period, you get this rich, fertile Levant. Then the Younger Dryas comes in, and I'm telling you the ancient weather report here. And then the Younger Dryas comes in, and everything dries up, but there'd been this population explosion. So the point is that agriculture may have started as a response to a crisis following a population explosion. So now you've got people trying to figure out how to feed themselves, and what do? By the way, we know that there were die-offs in Mediterranean culture around this time. So what do? They start looking at grains that are surviving the drought. They start trying to plant varieties of grains that will survive the new conditions. Why don't they just move? Well, because the people around them are in the same position, right? So the point is, agriculture, this is the point for your notes, agriculture was a forced option in Mesopotamia because it was a way of dealing with the crisis of a population explosion and the Younger Dryas. You get that in your notes? All right, so I'm just picking out kind of the main narrative here. So initially, it's very important, I've said this before, but it comes up in this article, in this chapter. Initially, agriculture was an iffy proposition. It took a lot of energy to produce a calorie. It took more energy to produce a calorie from agriculture than from hunter-gathering at that time. So agriculture was not what we learned in school, like, well, it's fertile, the Fertile Crescent, how wonderful, everybody must have been ecstatic, and we start growing a lot of food, everybody's happy. No, that's not what we're talking about here. The best theory these days is that agriculture was a forced option, which initially was a very iffy proposition, and once we got good at it, populations started doubling every 1,000 years. It's like bad news in both directions, right? First it didn't work, and then we got good at it, and we started overpopulating again. And then, as you know, the story is going to be, and then we screwed up the soil. So he takes you through early evidence of soil depletion. And I don't know what you guys thought, but I think this idea that in many, not just Mesopotamia, but in many, we're going to find this in Judaism, which comes later, and in other parts of the world, religious elites controlled food production and distribution. Was that a surprise to any of you? It was to me. You knew this before? Good. Yeah. It's interesting because it shows you that, I'm sorry, I don't want to get into a big digression on it, but I think it's really important that food and religion are connected this way. I don't know if any of you have a better way of drawing out the point. So what comes with the success of agriculture? This part does match the story you got in middle school or high school. Let's make a list. What comes with agriculture? Class differences, divisions of labor. This is where you get enough. Once we start getting a lot of energy from agriculture, we get overpopulation. We get people who don't have to work in agriculture, so you get the possibility of philosophers, which I think was probably an improvement, right? You get priests. So you could say agriculture brings about these changes. You get property, you get inequality. Let's get this on your list, right? Class differences, different division of labor, property, inequality, social conflict, government, writing. Writing comes from this town, Uruk. It's connected with Uruk. If any of you go to the Field Museum, go to Chicago, go to the University of Chicago Field Museum. Field Museum anthropologists were some of the first anthropologists to get this data. They're incredible artifacts in this museum. It's a great, great visit. So let's just broaden this a little bit. I want to send this book around. I wish I'd had more time to take some quotes out of it, but he's reflecting a thesis which is discussed widely among anthropologists. So I just wanted to give you this guy's name, Ian Morris, Foragers, Farmers, and Fossil Fuels. And what he argues is that, consistent with this discussion about the changes that agriculture brings in, he points out that, he cites research that hunter-gatherers had relatively gender-equal societies, that hunter-gathering as a practice didn't favor one gender over the other, didn't produce government because people moved around, didn't produce property because people moved around. There's evidence that hunter-gatherer societies today, that have existed today, don't have the kinds of gender inequalities that agricultural societies have. So why would agricultural societies bring about gender inequality? Well, Morris's argument is that each of these epochs, foragers, farmers, and fossil fuels, have their own values associated with them. So once you get to agriculture, more value is put on male labor. Right? So put it in your notes this way. The anthropological theory, it's one theory among many. I'm not going to tell you it's the only one. The anthropological theory of Morris is that gender inequality begins when the food production favors the physically bigger gender. And he's got a very persuasive story to tell. It would be a great reading group book for them.
Even with like male hunters, like in that society, there wasn't.
I know you would have think, wow, hunter-gatherers, the hunting that puts the guy kind of in a pretty important position. And it is true that in hunter-gatherer societies, the men did hunt and the women did. But when you look at this, when you get the whole story, there's a lot of equality in the power centers of what the women were doing and what the men were doing.
Were they gathering for the collective group or just for like self?
For the group. We're talking about groups of humans in the small dozens. Yeah.
So, like, you would collect as much as you could and put it in a store.
No storing at this point. Very little storing in hunter-gathering societies.
So you're just trying to feed yourself?
You're feeding the group, but the women are doing cooking. Remember, cooking occurs before agriculture, and food storage does occur before agriculture. But men and women are doing very different kinds of food production, but it's not producing gender inequalities, according to Morris. And then when you get to fossil fuels, he's got a big story to tell about that. It's really interesting. But the point for your notes would be that Montgomery and Morris would both agree that food might be driving more of history than we think. That's the point for your notes. Food might be driving culture and values and government and gender, because food production has gender consequences. It has, right? So when we usually tell the story of history, it's all about humans and empires and desires to expand and wars. Well, the story you're going to get in Montgomery is that maybe we can explain more of that by the human experience of food and food production. Because one of the themes in this, you can put it in your notes now, just to ruin the surprise here. You get this actually in the next week's reading. One of the themes in Montgomery's work is that our inability, put it in your notes, it's good to have it now, our inability to sustain agriculture causes empires to look for more territory. So our failure at sustainable agriculture drives empires' expansion. It's a really interesting thesis. He's going to prosecute it a bit more next week. But that's what I mean by saying food drives more of history. Food production and food, the human encounter, the human relationship to food drives more of history than we typically tell. We typically say, oh, and then this empire existed and they ate. Oh, and then this empire existed. Oh, and they ate too. But when you look at the Roman Empire, the story you're going to get next week is that a better explanation for the fall of the Roman Empire is that they had food problems. problems feeding their population. And that's part of the standard story. That's not like a radically different thing to say, but it's how much prominence you give it in the story. Okay, so I'm almost in sync with my time here. Feel free to bring in comments. I don't want to shut that down.
Food also
please
wins and loses wars.
Yeah, absolutely. Early, yeah, in food, military histories, it's the start. In the Civil War, we lost more soldiers but from starvation and bad food than sometimes from the battles.
Right? Stalingrad.
Yeah, good. Okay, so that's the main theme you get from the Mesopotamia segment. And then it's very important that silting and salination are big, are patterns in the failures of agriculture. Then you get a dimension of the story that takes you into Egypt, and I just want to give you the outline of that. It's the key facts in there. The Nile was a unique, self-sustaining ecosystem because it brought silt in proper amounts from the river and humus, organic material, from the more dense jungle areas of that part of Africa. And so for 7,000 years, the Nile Valley produced increasing yields. That's amazing. There's no other place on Earth that we have evidence that that was true. But it was from a unique ecosystem. So then what changed that happy story was the desire of modern Egypt to produce food for export, to get export dollars. And we're going to find this also in California. Was one of the things that's ruining California produce is that California has a huge export market, so that we're not just trying to produce food for us. So when Egyptians did this, they moved to year-round irrigation. Put this in your notes. Egyptian failure of agriculture after 7,000 years of incredible success. When food was produced for export, you had to irrigate and produce food all year round. Brought in salination in the late 1880s. No, I'm sorry. Yeah. Was that right? 1880s, salination became extreme. And then in the 20th century, we built the Nasser Dam. Huge disaster from the standpoint of managing the hydro cycle. And so that's it. So that's the Egyptian story. So we're getting lining up stories of failure, right? The Chinese story is amazing, right? You have the silting problem leads people, starting in 340 BC, China starts to dam and divert this huge fertile plateau coming off the Tibetan plateau, and by the 19th century, to take the silt out, they built these huge levees, and you have to imagine, as he says in the article, you have to imagine Chinese farmers taking buckets of dirt up this levee that eventually gets to 30 feet high, and in the 19th century and early 20th century, when there would be floods and high rains, these levees would break and cause millions of people to die. So China's pattern is a little different. Same problem with silting. Massive response. Like, okay, we've got a lot of people, we can do this. And so you just build up these huge levees, which eventually just cause huge catastrophes. So in the early 20th century, there's a European guy there named Walter Loudermilk. And he's there kind of working on famine protection. And all you need to know about him that I think is pretty interesting is that he follows one of these rivers into some desolate place, and he discovers evidence of ancient failure of agriculture in China. In other words, the same story repeated itself in all three of these places. It took a long time to screw up the Nile, but the Chinese and Mesopotamian stories are interestingly parallel with slight differences. So the thesis you get from this, you know, which I've kind of hinted already, that civilizations are defined by their management of their soil. Which is interesting when you think, if we're living soil, it's kind of interesting. It's almost like failure to manage ourselves. Okay. Thoughts on that? Are we good? I'm sorry I rushed the last bit of that. I want to leave time to meet with the folks doing the diet review. Okay. Okay, can we break there then? Is that good? Okay, stick around if you're doing the diet review exercise, and we'll talk about where you are with that, and otherwise I'll see you next week. course. What is happening? The folks who are doing one of the first two steps or one or two steps of this optional assignment are sticking around so we can figure out how they're going to do it. And what
so it's not too late.
Not too late to do it, no. No,
okay.
It's still 2 weeks till the first deadline for the step one.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I'd like a better visual. I don't know if I have this right. Yeah. You just have. What I imagine is the river silts up, so that you dig it out and pile it up on the side.
Yeah.
And then the river kind of raised level, and then because you can't keep up with it.
Right.
So you can imagine this elevated river up to 30 feet high, and now you've got a river that's like above it.
And it mentioned that it was like yielding larger, whatever there.
Was it?
Wasn't it?
I don't know. Yeah. It keeps the system going, but
right.
In China,
it's
case,
ironic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, great.
Okay.
Yeah, good.
Hey, quick question.
Sure.
In a couple weeks, I'm meeting with the Sodexo regional director.
Oh, cool.